Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Mark Sluka. His third novel is called Brewster. It's published by Norton. And when I read it, I liked it so much that I chose it for our Angel Club book. And this is a very good time for people to join the Angel Book Club because you'll get a book like Mark Sluka's. This is called Brewster. It's set in the 60s in upstate New York. And you remember how when you were young and you read a book, maybe it was like Lassie Come Home or Black Beauty or Lad a Dog, and you just started to feel something was going to happen in this book that would break your heart, and you read it with even greater excitement. Brewster is like that. It's about kids who are so definitely going to be wounded by their experience of this cold upstate New York town, by the widening generation gap between kids and their parents. These are parents who probably would have been very difficult, even if there weren't a generation gap widening. Tell me, where do these people come from? They seem very well known by you.
First of all, thanks for having me. This is terrific. They come from my past. They come from my experience. They come from my family. You know, Brewster is a novel about the sort of the unlikely friendship between these two boys. John Mosher is the son of German-Jewish refugees. Rake Picciano is kind of a James Deanish kind of brawler. Both of these kids are bearing more than they ought to be bearing. And I actually knew a kid very much like Ray Kapp. We were friends. He was tougher than I was, tougher than I'll ever be. And he had a little brother named Gene who was 12 years younger. And I remember even as a kid at 14 being impressed by the kind of love that I saw there. I mean, Ray, you know, my Ray would have done anything for that kid. So they come out of experience. They come out of listening, out of just hanging around the planet, I guess, for 55 years.
Well, you've spoken in different authors' notes in different places about the difference between the truth that comes from fiction and the truth that comes from life, and that they are different. And it seems to me that one of the moving things here, it's an intersection point between the truth of life and the truth of fiction. Both are operative here.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I think that fiction does contain certain kinds of truth that are apart, maybe beyond what we've actually lived. I also think that anything that has slipped into the past, any moment that has actually passed, has entered the domain of fiction. If you tell me what you did this morning, you know, after breakfast, it'll create a kind of a fiction. You'll leave certain things out. You'll stress other things you think are more interesting. So I think fiction sort of rules our lives on every level. For me, it's a matter of looking at how storytelling, fiction, sort of bleeds into our reality all the time. I mean, that's kind of where I live as a writer.
Well, I've been thinking, because of the number of times that Brewster brought me near tears, that in a way, it's an old-fashioned fiction truth, the truth that makes you cry, because we've learned in our time to say get a life or get over it. You know, there are a lot of things about learning to cope and learning to avoid the emotional confrontation. But these kids are dying because they can't put into words the horrible things that are going on around them.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I'm interested in how we sort of survive the life we've been given. And, you know, fate doles out certain little gifts along the way. And, you know, I thought a good deal about who these people are that I sort of put on the page. And the only way I could really talk about them was to say something along the lines of these are two kids who sort of exemplify the notion of sort of decency under pressure. I mean, they're decent kids, and I think of them as kids because they are. And they're doing everything they can to survive what they've been dealt, the hand they've been dealt. And they're fighting their own sort of inner wars, their own family wars, which are the worst kind in some way. And how they're able to come out of that, how a certain kind of pressure can lead to friendship or love, really, because that's very much what the book is about in my mind, is just interesting to me. Why is it that some people are able to survive the most ungodly stuff, whereas others bend or break? To me, that's material for storytelling.
Well, the mother in Brewster, the mother of John.
Yeah, John Mosier, yeah.
Well, this is a kind of behavior that was immediately familiar to me. I remember coming home as a kid to meet a mother who decided she wasn't talking to me or couldn't talk for a while or needed to be in bed napping.
Oh, yeah.
And it seemed to be a mode of behavior for mothers of that time to have had too much to take. And now, forget it. You can't make them smile. What's the matter?
Right.
What's
yeah.
the matter is the question.
Yeah, yeah.
Asked again and again.
Wrong?
What did I do wrong?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's you've put your finger right on sort of the, for me, sort of the emotional center of the novel, the relationship between John and his mother. She blames him unfairly for the death of his older brother. But she's also my mother. I mean, my mother spent 25 years mourning the sort of the ideal little boy that I was. And I spent too long sort of standing in front of her saying, I'm right here. I'm the same son. Nothing's changed. I'm just a little taller, you know, a little bigger. In the book, I kind of literalize that. I mean, the ideal son dies and the non-ideal one has to live on in the shadow of that loss.
Well, you wrote a novel about Chang and Eng, the famous Siamese twins, and here too, the dead son,
wow.
who was the
yeah.
good son, and the living, so-called bad son, the one who, I can't believe we've raised this.
Yeah, this
says the
yeah.
mother. And yeah. Well, I thought I'd ask you to read the section about the parents and that early part of childhood, which the narrator, John, barely remembers.
Yeah, it'd be my pleasure. All right, so this is fairly early on in the novel. When I was four, my brother Aaron, who had blonde hair after my mother's father, plugged in a lamp he'd found on the street and died. It happens. I was playing in the living room when I heard my father screaming, and a few seconds later, my mother. I'd passed Aaron on the stairs a few minutes before, carrying something up. "Shh," he said. I never saw him again. I could have said something. I didn't. And anything I said after that didn't really matter much. The things you don't say, you can't take back. And that was that. We didn't talk about him. I remember walking by his room and seeing his bed, his shelf, the punching bag dinosaur in the corner, the toys on his desk, all quiet like in an aquarium, and thinking he'd be coming home from school. I think now they just broke. People break just like anything else. They'd lost everything once, now they'd lost it again. And they broke. No more to it. I'm not making any claim to anything. You read worse stories in the paper every day. Nothing changed, and everything did. My father went back to work because the store was there, because somebody had to go. We ate at the same table. I watched the same shows. Every morning for 14 years, my mother went into my brother's room and pulled the curtains, then closed them at night. Once a week, she dusted and vacuumed. She didn't talk to me much. It was like something inside her had frozen. When I was little and couldn't sleep, I'd come downstairs to find my father in the leather chair looking over the top of some book by Stifter or Büchner or Musil, as if he was confused by something he'd read. My mother would be sitting at the kitchen table in front of a closed magazine, and she'd push herself up with her arms and make me some warm milk. I was four when he died, so I don't remember much. I remember going into his room and taking a toy and my mother grabbing the hair on the back of my head and slapping my face three times, not back and forth, but the same side, then bursting into tears. And And I remember standing in our yard watching Mr. Perullo reaching down into the gutters and throwing big flapping handfuls of wet leaves off our roof, and my father pleading in that accent like Colonel Klink's and Hogan's Heroes, "Really, Tony, you do not have to do that." And Mr. Perullo not even looking at him, saying, "Forget about it, Sam, almost done." When I was 5 or 6, the neighbors had a block party on the 4th, like every year. The cops blocked off the street, and there were hanging paper lanterns and kids running everywhere, and people laughing from the porches or standing around in groups in the shadows, so all you could see was their light-colored shirts or pants. It was hot and sticky, and if you looked into the backyards, you could see the fireflies sparking up in the weeds. The air smelled like smoke and grass and burning meat. I found my father sitting on the top step of the Monturi's porch in his dress shirt and slacks, and I sat down next to him between the paper plates and the half-filled Dixie cups. And even though it was dark, I remember watching yellow jackets moving in the beer, like something trying to wake up. "The wood is still warm," he said, putting his hand on the boards next to him. And then he didn't say anything more until I heard a kind of hissing sound and realized he was crying. He'd taken his glasses off, and he was holding his nose with his right hand like he wanted to hide it, and his shoulders were jerking up and down. I didn't know what to do. His left hand was just lying next to him on the porch, palm up, so I put my hand in it, but nothing happened. It was like it had fallen asleep. And after a while, I took my hand back. Sometimes it felt like there'd been some kind of mistake, like I was the one who died and nobody wanted to admit it. Mostly, I didn't know what to do. I have only one memory from before. I remember walking around the ball field, the grass like a carpet under the water, and seeing small, dark fish, probably perch, shooting through the backstop fence. The East Branch had flooded. My father was there, and so was Aaron. There were clouds all around us, and the bleachers had water up to the first seat, and we walked around the bases with our pants rolled up, looking for the white squares under the water, and the fish running away from us looked like somebody pushing his finger up against the surface. My father threw me on his shoulders. He seemed big then. I have a memory of my brother, I think, eating snow and peeing on a worm. That's it.
Mark Slucka, reading from an early chapter of his novel, Brewster. Now, one of the things that I notice and immediately want to comment about, there are very few words more than 2 syllables. 3 is a rarity. And Mark Slucka is known for his passionate and rhetorical essays in Harper's Magazine, where, well, in a way, it's a very literate ranting about the death of feeling in our time.
Yeah.
And this seems to be a book that is about the recovery of feeling. It wants to make you feel on every page. Memory is being utilized to bring back even emotions that don't have words. And sometimes the muteness of it makes for an importunate and, well, quiet wailing noise. I wondered if it was difficult to master the vocabulary of 1 and 2 syllable words after so much rhetorical thunder.
It was very difficult at first. I spent 2 years trying to sort of fight my way into this novel. I kind of had to shed my skin, I guess. But once I had the voice of this boy, John Mosier, then it all began to flow in a way. This novel is very much a kind of a homecoming for me, I guess. An awakening, maybe, is a better word. I spent a lot of years writing about my parents' generation, their stories, their time, the Second World War, etc. This was the first time I came home in a literary sense. I fell in love with the English language, with the sort of New York area vernacular, with the poetry of it. But part of that poetry was also a kind of a brevity. The eloquence of silence is something that really interests me. The different forms that silence can take in, you know, on the page. What's not said can break your heart.
Well, it seems to me that we, the readers now, hear about a boy named Ray Cappuccino.
Yeah.
We just know that a boy with that name would be being called Cappuccino, you know?
Yeah,
and we
probably
can hear him not being called it. It's a different time. He's called Ray Cap.
That's right.
And the level of mockery between the kids is not all that high, verbal mockery, because they use their fists more.
Yeah.
They're so physical with one another and so harsh. And in doing that, you see, they're like their parents. And it seems in this book, there are two choices, the physical and punishing, or the silent and withholding. And it's one or the other. And one of the boys who is physical meets one of the boys who's been drenched in silence by his parents, and they try and say something to one another. And it's kind of amazing to be hearing them talk, because it doesn't come naturally to either of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, John Mosher's a bookish kid. He's a bookish, withdrawn kid who's in pain. He's, you know, I mean, for him, it's all about the wages of grief and of guilt and learning how to deal with that. And he's drowning. I mean, he says at some point, you know, in Brewster, you had two choices. You could choke or fight. Well, he's choking, and it's not a pretty thing. And then what happens is that he runs into someone who he doesn't even realize at first is, you know, is going down even faster than he is. And Ray Kapp is, he's a tough kid. I mean, I knew a kid a lot like Ray. And he's the sort of kid who's going to hide it. There's a lot of bravado, but they recognize something in each other, some mutual need. And I actually believe that that's often how life works. I mean, often when you were drowning, if you're lucky, life will point you to someone who at least will recognize what you're going through because they're going through it. And together you can form some sort of an alliance for time. And that can be very intense because there's a gratitude involved in it. It's like, my God, this person understands. They understand what I'm going through. And that's the kind of friendship I tried to create here. Hopefully it seems as real as it did to me.
And also, you capture very well that strange mix and match. When my parents hated me, my friend's parents would serve me ginger snaps and
yeah,
soda.
Yeah.
And vice versa. My parents were very good at finding out that my neighbor down the block, that kid did better on the test than me, and he became their desired son.
Yeah.
So both sets of these horrifying parents, well, they get the silent ones all talky with Ray.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the violent one, an ex-cop who is so fierce that even other cops know that this man's son has a problem.
Yeah.
They don't want to take him in because, yes, with a father like that, he might be or do anything.
Yeah.
That man's father speaks with a kind of condescending respect to the young bookish boy in his house. Maybe you'll be my lawyer someday.
Yeah, right. Exactly, yeah. Well, it's a respect with a barb in the tail. But it's true, isn't it, that often it's easier for people to be kind to those who aren't, you know, of their family, of their clan. You know, it was true in my family, as apparently it was in yours to some extent. God, do I understand that. And I remember it so well.
Well, that's why I want to recommend this book, Brewster, because it's like a return to feelings when they could be read more clearly and addressed maybe more drastically, but without hiding. You know, this is a book about feeling and a time in America when the feeling and the avoidance of feeling, this was the subject of life. And maybe I read this book with a great deal of sorrow because it's so uncommon now to feel in such a sustained way.
Well, I think things have changed in a lot of ways. I mean, they've changed in literature, I think. I mean, irony is covering a lot of bases these days. And you know, you kind of stick your neck out when you allow a certain emotion to come out straight. But I also think, I mean, the 60s play a big role in this book, and I think the 60s were a time of a certain kind of intense feeling, whether it was from people who were seeking to be seen, to be acknowledged, I mean, that was part of the whole sort of the zeitgeist of the period, right? Well, that's what my guy is doing. He wants to be acknowledged. I'm right here. You know, I'm alive.
Mom, I'm here.
I'm here. I'm your
right
son.
I'm right next to you.
I'm right here, you know? And, but in a way, that's, you know, what's that about the, you know, politics always being personal and vice versa? It's this is his battle as well, and the battles for liberation being fought all around him in the distance somewhere are being played out in his own family.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking to Mark Sluka about his book Brewster. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Mark Sluka about his new book, Brewster, the hopeful story of teenage boys in their quest for freedom from their town. In one of your essays, you quote Herman Melville saying that silence is the voice of God. Now, as soon as I saw it, I wanted to say, perhaps silence is the voice of God, or how could he be so certain? How could he say silence is the voice of God? It's the question of a much later time than his. It's the question of the concentration camp. Is silence
truly the voice of our God? Yeah.
Yes. And there's a Browning poem that ends, "And yet God did not say a single word," mm-hmm. at the end of a man strangling his wife with her own hair, Porphyria's lover. But this is, in a way, a book about finding the place where silence breaks down and yields impassioned speech or sickness, vomit.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
these characters are being forced to feel. It's what this book is going to do.
I think so. There's kind of an explosion into speech, because both of these boys are bottled up. You know, we said that they're drowning. They're incapable of articulating what's happening to them. Partly because they're 17. You know, they're kids. They don't. That all these things are happening around them, all these things are happening in their personal lives, but they don't have the tools yet. They don't know how to rationalize. They don't know how to articulate. They're just fighting to stay afloat. But part of the problem is that because they don't have the language, they also don't have what would facilitate their escape from that predicament that they're in. Eventually, the events force that articulation. And you could even say that by John Mosher narrating this book, this is the answer. This is the book is the speech that he was incapable of making when he was 17, 18 years old, when he desperately needed to communicate. Well, now he's communicating it. And along with that comes some kind of self-understanding.
And a knowledge that then he really didn't know how to help his friend. And he has some kind of idea, not what he would do now, but that he would have done something. And that's a huge moment in life, when you realize that letting it pass because you don't know what to do is no longer to be accepted. To be an adult, to become human, is to always do something, no matter what.
Yeah.
We know in this book somehow, everyone has mentioned it, that someone else is going to die. I'm not going to say who, but we are not going to witness that death. But it is going to be reported so that the reader mourns the way the narrator, Ray, mourns.
Yeah. It's you know, I mean, we only know ourselves in, you know, we only see ourselves in the rearview mirror, right? We only know ourselves in retrospect. And I think that's true. And I mean, John is very much like that. It's only now that he's able to look back and understand to some extent who he was, who Ray was, what the situation was, what the predicament was that they'd found themselves in, because he's not in it anymore, and it's receded in the background. I'm always interested in how memory works and in how memory can distort and fictionalize and sort of reveal certain things, but also, I don't know, also enlarge them to us so that we can actually see who we were once much more accurately than we could when we were there.
But in this book, it doesn't feel as if there's an easy solution. This is the problem that we all face, how to love, and sometimes we only succeed after a death. And that is a part of the book, too, the death of parents, the death of friends, that all of this love can be discovered after the fact.
Oh, the conversation never ends. That's exactly right. It's sometimes, I think, after the death of let's say, a parent, the conversation actually kind of begins, which is an odd and in some ways a wonderful thing. But, you know, it takes all sorts of forms. I was talking to a woman who's probably 80 years old, whose mother just passed away at 104 recently. And she said, you know, I waited for 80 years to have her say, you're okay. And it never happened. And it was just one of those moments, just like kind of hair-raising moments where you think, my God, this woman was here on this planet for 104 years and never managed, you know, in 80 of them, to say to her kid, you know what, you're okay. You're all right. I mean, 80 years. And, you know, that's a conversation that hasn't ended. Trust me, this 80-year-old lady is still having that talk with mom and will probably always be having it. And that's okay. I think the endings that we think are endings rarely are. I don't really believe in endings. I think there are all kinds of continuations, echoes, returns. It's one of the things I find so interesting about writing, because you can explore those.
I've been talking with Mark Sluka, author most recently of Brewster, published by W.W. Norton, and the current Angel Book Club book, one I recommend to everyone, whether in the club or not. Thank you, Mark, for joining me.
This has been a real pleasure. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Brewster at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Russ Kick is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.